Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome to the next episode of Drugs and Stuff with Dave Crossland. Today, we're going to go back over microdosing a little bit, clear up some bits and bobs, as Dave would say. Then using TRT or low test dosing along with higher doses of other compounds. We've got a topic we're going to talk about, AAS in sports. What does a cycle look like for an athlete versus a bodybuilder? And Dave got to talk to the newspaper today. So we're gonna talk a little bit about that as well. It's all going to come up next here on Drugs and Stuff.
Advices Radio Network.
Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to Drugs and Stuff. I'm Scott McNally. Of course, I'm here with Dave Crossland. If you guys haven't hit the subscribe button yet, if you enjoy the stuff, then definitely please consider hitting the button. And if you enjoy the show, hit the like. It helps us to spread our programming to more people. Dave, what's up, man? How you been?
Not bad. Just getting back into the swing and routine of things after, you know, the festive period.
Yes.
Getting used to getting up and going to work again, sort of thing. But yeah, not bad. Fairly busy. Trying to be more organized and more structured, so I'm more efficient with my time.
That's a big one. I've learned. So that was a big goal of mine, was organization for 2019, and it just so happened that I met Victoria, who, as you can imagine, she's beyond, like, she's amazingly structured with her day. I mean, she, every morning, the last thing she does before we settle down for the evening is gets her journal out. And she writes out her plan for the next day. And the first thing is wake up. The second thing is make the bed. And she checks everything off. And she said she puts those on there still because that way she starts the day on a positive foot. You know, you're doing something that you know you can complete. You're on a roll. And then the next tasks, you know, they aren't as daunting. So I'm trying to get into a habit of that. I have I've got it right here, Dave. I've been putting together notes for what my plan is for each day, and then I can check them off as I go, each thing I need to accomplish.
I'm all right if I'm in the office.
Okay.
I struggle when I'm, so like, I'll generally stay down here 6, 7, 8 p.m., depends.
Okay.
And then I'll go upstairs, and that's where I start to screw up, because I'll get messages on an evening, I'll answer them, and then I'll completely forget I've answered them. Or I completely forget I've got something to do the next day that I was talking about. And I've tried keeping little notepads, and then I forget where I put my notepad.
Yeah.
Or I haven't got a pen. So I really need to. I mean, the stupid thing is, it's all on my phone. I can quite easily record voice notes on the phone. So
for sure,
I need to get into the habit of using the digital memory of my phone in a way of reminding me that the next morning I can then transfer it all into my diary. But I use my diary a lot. I mean, it's, you know, that's.
Oh, nice.
Every day. It's just listed out.
You have to. You know what I mean? If you go to a 9-to-5 job, your boss has a list of tasks for you to do each day. But if you're your own boss, you're the guy who's got to have that list of tasks. It makes it a lot easier. I'm going to go over to our YouTube page because we got a question yesterday. We had a couple of questions actually from the previous show. Let me hit pause on this. So one thing, I wanted to clear up a little confusion. There was one guy who I don't think he understood what we were talking about exactly when we talked about long esters and microdosing. He said, how is using long esters like enanthate very frequently, like, for example, every day, leading to a lower dose when your body is increasing the clearance rate? Shouldn't that be the same overall dose with a shorter half-life? So I think he's wondering, so if you're, I'm not sure if I quite understand his question exactly, but the way I read it, Dave, was he's asking us, why is it any different, your blood levels, if you do it every day versus just one big shot per week due to the half-life?
There will be a point of diminishing return with this, so there will be a certain level of balance. With something like testosterone, I'm trying to get the numbers right. So you'll get, as you get increased clearance of a drug, it stays in your longer for a shorter period of time.
Okay.
So if you inject 500 milligram of, I'll do it this way, make it nice and simple. You'd inject 700 milligram of test on a Monday.
Okay.
As opposed to injecting 100 milligram of testenth every other day or every day. So that same dose per weekly period. Yeah. Right. The half-life reduces down from 10.5 to, it's either 6.5 or 4.5 days. Can't remember. I'll have to check.
Yeah.
So we'll say for just average it as half. So it clears the rate twice as quick. So as a result, your 700 milligram of test end on a Monday in 10.5 days is 350 milligram.
Okay.
Your 700 milligram over 7 days, well, your first injection of 100 milligram is effectively gone. Because that's now clearing at a rate of 5 days. So in 10.5 days, that's down to 25 when it would have been still up at 50. So the residual drug doesn't stay in the system as long, drops off faster. So as a result, your overall dosing is reduced.
Your levels don't. My thought was that your levels aren't. They don't reach as high of a. If you take it up higher and you have a higher peak,
you'll have a higher peak as well with a single dosing. Yes,
that was. I guess that was my thought, was that you get that higher peak that it drops down from.
If a drug clears out faster,
yeah,
it, as a single dose, you're still gonna have the same effective amount of hormone going through the system. But because testenth is accumulative, so when I put my 700 in on the following Monday, I've still got effectively 400 floating around in my system active.
Yeah.
So I'm now a total of 11. With the increased half-life, because it's clearing out faster, you don't have the residual. So you don't have the same accumulation of compounding your body over the period of time.
Yeah, I think too. I mean, and we're just kind of, I feel like this conversation,
it is an oversimplification, but it gives you the basic principle of the fact that you can speed up the clearance of a drug and inadvertently then, as a result, actually have a lower active dose in your system than you realize.
And that's what I was going to say, is that we're kind of oversimplifying it for the purpose of this conversation and just to kind of give some general understanding, because I feel like at the end of the day, it's always going to be individual. When we say that the clearance of a given ester is X amount of days, that's, you know, we've found, Scott Stevenson had pointed out in various studies that the half-life is very different for individuals than what it actually says on paper, than what we read on the boards. When you read that test sip is like 10 days, you know, in real world experience, some people it might be 3 days, you know? So
it's predominantly, a big contributing factor to that is actually body fat level.
Really?
Yeah. Higher body fat, you will have a higher rate of clearance.
Huh. No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
So yeah, body fat contributes massively to the rate of clearance.
I had no idea about that.
I don't know why. I did know, but I've forgotten. It's a long time since I looked at this. But yeah, if you increase the body fat levels in an individual, they will clear drugs at a higher rate.
Okay. So we had that one come up, and then we also had a topic that came up, and I believe that I messaged this one over to you ahead of time. So I'm going to scroll back here. Okay. So he says, just listened to the latest drugs and stuff. You guys brushed on a point at 39 minutes, 30 seconds in. Dave mentioned about how his cycle plans for clients are typically 300 to 500 milligrams of test plus an androgen. Would like to know as much as possible. Seems to be more common, I hear, of people running, for example, a base of 300 milligrams of test with 600 milligrams of DECA instead of 600 test and 300 DECA. So I've seen this a lot more. I agree with him. I've seen this a lot more in modern days, you know, recent days, I should say, recent years, that people are using more of a TRT level of test or a lower level of test and then really hammering the cycle with something else. Like something else is really going to be, you know, the driving force, you know, mm-hmm. be it EQ, be it DECA, be it Tren. It's real popular with Tren. I've seen a lot of people do a TRT dose of test with, you know, a load of Tren I know one thing that they say, Dave, is that they get less side effects using dosing like that. But what's your thoughts and reasoning behind this? Because this isn't something that I do, but I'm definitely interested to learn about it.
Well, I think the history of how this to a lot of people came popular was because people were piss poor at managing the drugs.
Okay.
So a lot of people struggle with estrogen-related sides, and that can get quite complex because they weren't managing their testosterone conversion very well. So I know people like Taryn Clark and who've pushed like Decaroni cycles and stuff like that. His whole reasoning behind that was because he was shit at managing his drugs. Well, he was particularly shit at managing his estrogen levels, and as a result, ended up with quite a few estrogen-related sides.
This is Aaron Clark, the pro bodybuilder?
No, Tyann.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't know what his last name is. Tyann.
I thought you said Aaron Clark for some reason.
No, I don't know. I might have said Tyann Clark, but I don't think his last name's Clark. Tyann something.
Okay, I misunderstood.
Anyway, I mean, I'm not having a blast at him. He openly admits he had major problems with estrogen management.
Okay.
So he decided to drop aromatizing drugs and run effectively non-aromatizing drugs. Oh, Deca aromatizes at a very low rate. I appreciate that. But my thought process is slightly different. I mean, most of the problems we get from drugs are because we fail to manage them correctly. It's not really the fault of the drug.
Yeah.
It's usually the fault of the user not understanding the drug, not realizing how the drug operates, and then failing to manage or negotiate, deal with those issues arising. Mine's more to do with the overall stress factors that drugs place on the body. So when you look at a drug, we have an anabolic and androgenic ratio. And though this isn't 100% strictly true, in layman's terms, excuse me, anabolic is how much muscle it builds, androgenic is how stressful it's going to be on you.
Okay.
It's not quite right, but it's a good layman's guide.
Yeah, sure. Androgens, also strength, right? Androgens strength it, but more sides, more hair growth, more androgen being more masculinizing side effects, really. Oily skin.
Virilization, and as a result, also more stress on internal organs and all that sort of thing. So test has always been the baseline because it's basically equal of both. So it's equally good at building muscle mass as it is at creating strength. And there's a proportionate level of stress on the body as a relation to that. But from a point of view of managing health and a point of view of managing growth, the most effective way to grow is when you are the least stressed.
Absolutely.
We all know that stress plays a huge factor in diminishing results when it comes to training and growth. And that can be any mental stress, physical stress, lack of sleep, stressful job, poor relationship, whatever it is that's causing those stress factors. And those stress factors come from high androgens as well. So the way I look at it is we need certain levels of compounds in a cycle. We need a certain level of DHT.
Sure.
We need a certain level of estrogen.
Sure.
To maintain healthy lipid profile and growth, because estrogen is still a strong factor in developing muscle as well.
And just feeling well too, right? Sense of well-being, libido,
all those things. We need certain elements of them. So we need an aromatizing drug to some degree, and we need to maintain a certain level of DHT to some degree.
Why don't we back up just for anybody who is super, super new to a topic like this? Why do we need to include a testosterone to do this while we're on cycle?
I wouldn't say we particularly have to include a testosterone.
But why?
But it converts to DHT. And our natural hormone system, our endocrine systems are designed to run on testosterone with DHT conversion and testosterone conversion to estrogen. That's how we produce hormones naturally.
And I was going real simple, I guess, too simple, was that we need this because our bodies aren't going to produce it on our own once we start taking the other compound.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, man. I'm trying to connect to everybody here is my thought.
proper 101. Yes.
Yes.
When we introduce compounds, obviously our natural production ceases.
Yeah.
So as a result, we are reliant on the drugs we're putting in to create estrogen, to create DHT, and they are base hormones that our bodies use.
Because if we just went off and, you know, say, Dave, you're talking about using DECA with this. If you just went off and you just did DECA only, then you would have, you know, that's the problem. People see something on a message board or, you know, they see these steroid profiles and they're like, oh, DECA creates all these gains. Why would I even want to mess around with testosterone? Why don't I just do DECA only?
And plenty of people do, and it's got almost a cult following as DECA only.
I've heard, man, and I don't get that one at all.
And now, when I've looked at it, a lot of these DECA only cycles generally aren't. They will have D-ball in there. They'll have some form of aromatizing compound in there, be it small. Those that truly run DECA only, for the most part, anyone that's extended that. So now, a lot of these cycles are recommended 4 on, 4 off, 6 on, 4 off, 6 on, 6 off. What I've noticed is that when people run DECA only cycles, even on something like a 4 on, 4 off, when they get into the third rotation of the third lot of 4 weeks on, they start to get a few issues. But not everybody. I know people that have run DECA only cycles and flourished on them. But personally, God, if you believe in that sort of thing, nature, whatever it is, design my body to run on DHT, testosterone, and estrogen.
Right on.
So I don't see any reason to try and overcome that, change that, circumvent that. So I like to put enough test in to cover those bases.
Okay.
So when I start my androgens, I know I've got enough DHT. I know I've got enough estrogen to support general health. Testosterone is neuroprotective, and the vast majority of steroids have a neuro impact. Now, over a certain dose, and I can't tell you what it is because I generally don't know. I don't think it's ever been looked at. But it's very much like alcohol. A small amount of alcohol is actually stimulant. The coup d'etat, which is a small amount of alcohol drunk in France in the morning and in Spain, is drunk to give you a bit of a boost, a bit of a kick up the arse, and it's like a third of a pint. It's a small amount of alcohol.
Oh, okay.
Now, if you increase that dosage of alcohol, it becomes a depressant.
Yeah.
And test is very much the same. You know, up to a certain level, it's going to be neuroprotective and neurostimulationing. Go over that, and it starts to have a negative impact in our neurochemical in the brain.
I can see that.
So I like to have that baseline covered. And then, depending on what I'm trying to achieve, I'll use the drug that has the least amount of stress on me physically and is going to give me the greatest amount of anabolic action. So, in a lot of cases, off-season, a very good for that is DECA. DECA has other negatives in other areas, so it does have issues within neuropharmacological issues within the brain. But physical impacts from DECA in the way of blood pressure, in the way of prostate enlargement, hair loss, oil, joints, tendons, bone density, it's actually, in most cases, quite positive. DECA is used as a treatment for osteoporosis. It increases bone density. We know it increases type 2 collagen synthesis. As it's a progestin, it triggers the progesterone receptor. As a result, we produce slightly more of an natural anti-inflammatory in our joints, which is why a lot of people report that DECA reduces joint pain, and why a lot of people report that Winstrol creates joint pain, because Winstrol is anti-progestogenic in its action, so it reduces the level of natural anti-inflammatories.
I've definitely felt the effect of Winstrol in the past when I'd used that.
And so it's about creating a drug profile that one, satisfies what you're trying to achieve, and two, does that with a minimum impact on your body in a negative aspect. Certain drugs, there's no escaping. You know, Tren, it's harsh. It's going to be harsh.
Yeah.
So if you're in a performance sport, a strength-based performance sport, where you're going to be running Tren, save it to the end. Don't be running 10, 12 weeks out when you know you've got a 12-week comp prep, because by the time you get to the comp, you're going to be fucked.
Yeah.
You know, the stresses of running strength for that period of time are going to start to have negative impacts on your strength. And as a result, you're going to start to end up going the opposite way. Mm. So some of it's learning how your body responds, and the healthier you keep your body, the higher your drug tolerance will be. But so I manage my androgen and anabolic levels with the drugs I'm using, depending on what I'm trying to achieve from the client. So off season for size, high anabolics, low androgens, because we're going to have plenty of food.
Yeah.
We don't want to be stressing the body because it's going to cope well with growth and getting strong because I'm able to eat lots of food and because I'm able to shift a load of weight. And it will recover well.
That's what you, is this what you subscribed to yourself when you were pushing your weight up?
No, it was more traditional.
Okay. That's what I had done too.
But that was more through obviously learning and developing and realizing.
Okay.
If I'm going more strength-based, then I'm going to look at higher androgens. But I'm going to limit the amount of time I have on those androgens.
Yeah.
If I've got multiple peaks, because I've got a qualifier 4 weeks later, I've got a regional 4 weeks later, I've got a final in, say, a strongman or powerlifting, then I will peak my androgens going into each comp, but I will literally drop them out for a week, 10 days post each comp. So I'm minimizing the amount of time on those androgens. I call it androgenic fatigue. I don't know if it's a correct term, but what you'll see if someone that's been running high androgens for an extended period of time is they just wear out. The bodies get overly stressed and things start to go wrong. Injuries and niggles start to appear. Yeah. They start to get more and more run down. Energy levels start to decline. Appetite starts to decline. Gut health starts to decline. And it's just because the androgens have been on so long. So when I build in multiple peak cycles, I will always look to drop the androgens low whenever is possible, even if it's only a week, because those weeks add up and it just gives your system a break.
Yeah, I can tell you that, you know, because early on, you know, in understanding this stuff, you know, my thought, like anybody else's, would have been like, you know, you do, let's say, a 16-week contest prep. You just, why not add the trend from the first week? Because then you're going to obviously 16 weeks of it has to be better than 8 weeks of it, you know. But in reality, I found that, yeah, if you keep your, and I know that you and I may not have, we don't do things necessarily the same when it comes to peaking, but my thought has been, you know, use it when you need it and stay as healthy and as strong as possible for, you know, as long as you can too. So
I think we have the basic same principle. Just, I don't push drugs too close to comp. Most people will ramp drugs up going into comp, and I think for most people they overdo it.
Sure, it's easy to do, man. Especially if you're in control of your own plan, if you're your own coach, you know, or you're making your own decisions, then yeah, it's the psychological side of not wanting to lose. You know, I mean, I've known so many people, including myself, where it's like, I think Halo will help, but I think I could get away with it too, and not using it too. But I'm not going to take the risk, so you throw the Halo in anyway.
Of course you do. You throw everything in because you're trying to win.
Exactly.
I think the thing is with comp prep, though, is it comp prep cycles, it's very difficult to do a comp set prep cycle as a standalone plan because they need to be quite fluid.
You mean like a plan, standalone plan, being a plan that's written on paper that you just follow out versus... Yeah. Oh, yeah. I agree, man. Yeah,
they need to be quite fluid because you need to really sort of adjust to what's going on. For argument's sake, if someone's coming down really well, they're maintaining a high level of strength, then I'd keep the drugs pulled back.
Yeah.
If they're starting to struggle a little bit and the strength's really crashing and as a result they're flattening out a lot and they're just not staying full and everything, then you might need to bump it up a little bit to compensate for the fact that the diet and everything else is taking its toll.
Absolutely.
And it's little things like, I love putting people on stage on Oxy, but I can only do it if they're shredded.
Yeah, yeah.
If they're not shredded, don't touch it because you're just going to water out and look a fat mess. But if you're shredded, you'll walk on as full as a house and dry as a bone.
I'd like to try that sometime. I've always gone the Halo route. You know, you can only pick, you only have so many things you can do, so many options you can pick, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, most people I'll cruise in the last 7 days on oral only. I'll just drop injectables. There's no big science behind it. I just don't want unsightly injection sites on stage.
Yeah. No, yeah, that's a good point too. Especially for somebody that's doing like frequent shots. Like if somebody who was on Trenace or something and, you know, absolutely, man, the further back, I made a mistake one time, I'll tell you, that I ran out of Tren for a show and I ran out like right at the end and it was like Thursday before the show. And I thought to myself, man, I need to get this shot still, you know? And a buddy of mine from the gym, he's like, oh yeah, I make my own Tren. It's really good. It's really smooth. And he gave me a couple CCs of it. And of course I used it and I got, I'd never used this Tren before. I got the nastiest lump from it, you know. It took a week and a half to go down, and obviously, man, thankfully I put it in my glute, but still, that's, you know what that is. If a judge sees that, they're not going to be happy. You know, you're not going to be happy.
It's not just that as well. It can affect your fluidness on stage when you pose because it's sore and it's pulsating or it's spasming as you move through a range.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's horses for courses, but definitely with comp cycles, I think you need to be a lot more on the fly, so you have a basic structure with options. And the one thing that a lot of people don't do, and I've never understood this, they don't pull things out.
Mm.
So if you're going for a comp prep and you're 8 weeks out, 6 weeks out, feeling great, and you're probably 2 weeks in condition ahead of schedule, and at this point on your cycle plan you've decided to add Tren, why? If everything's going fine, don't bother.
If everything's going fine, I'm scared to change anything. I don't want to add stuff a lot of times. You know, it's like.
Lot of people will say, oh, it's on my plan. I've got to add it. And it's like, well, no. If you're progressing well and everything's where it needs to be, leave it out.
Yeah.
You don't need it. And it's always simpler when you come to those last 24 hours to manipulate what's going on with the less things going on in the formula, because the more complex it is at that point, the more of a nightmare it is to know what the fuck's doing what here.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I've seen some pre-comp cycle plans that read like shopping lists.
No. If you add in a fat burner, you know, and then you add in another form, like let's say a T3. So now you've got a fat burner and a T3, plus you're using something that's going to be, you know, your test, and then, you know, whatever else, a DHT. We're talking, there's five things right there. Are you using growth? There's six, you know.
Same like fat burners. You see people starting a comp prep, and from week one, they're on fat burners.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, your diet's going to take care of your first 4 or 5 weeks.
Sure.
You only really need to introduce the fat burners as you start to get to the point where the normal dieting process becomes less productive because you're getting to the point where you're getting so much leaner. And then your body's natural preservative sticks in, and where it's saying, look, I don't want to lose any more fat because this is dangerous for me now. I'm getting too lean.
Yeah.
And it's like stimulatory fat burners. So your ephedrines, your T5s.
Yeah.
Hold them back until you start dragging your ass, and then use them as a double whammy. So you get a boost in your fat burning properties and you get a boost in getting through everyday life.
Sure. Hey, I'm going to steer us back then to using a lower dose test. So, you know, years ago, the big thing was if you're going to use DECA, you would want to run your test higher than DECA to avoid sexual dysfunction, you know, better known as DECA dick. So what's your answer to that then? Because this is something people were terrified of years ago, you know, that you had to run more tests than DECA.
You can still run it that way. There's nothing negative about that. Where a lot of people were having problems with what was coined as decadic, what they were actually having problems with was estrogen. And because their test was high, then they also weren't remembering that deca converts to estrogen at a rate of 20% of test. So they were having estrogen issues, and that was what was causing the decadic. The problem was then that when they suddenly realized that and slammed the estrogen down, that caused a prolactin spike.
Okay.
Because if you run high estrogen and then you bring it down rapidly, which is what we all do when we realize we've got high estrogen, we slam some Adex in and we slam some Aromacin in and we get it down, that then triggers a spike in prolactin.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, well, I've got my ears under control, but my knob's still not working, so I've got Decadent. No, you've got hypolactin. Because you've allowed estrogen to run high and then dropped it, your body thinks you're given birth and it started to give you ability to lactate. So it shoved the prolactin through the roof to compensate. If you run high estrogen and drop it fast, you'll boost prolactin up through the roof. Even though we are male, we start with those basic female molds. Hence why we've got nipples and all that crap. So when it comes to our hormones, our body will still respond in a female pattern if we allow female hormones to get out of range.
Yeah.
You know, should that happen? No, we should never start to lactate. We are males. We don't need to feed babies. But then in normal circumstances, our estrogen would never be sitting at 300-400 empo either. So you've created an artificial scenario. So you're going to get an unnatural response. So it does Deca's action. I'm not, everyone says Deca causes hyperprolactin, and there is something to do with its action as a progestin. It's not a true progestin, but and for those that don't know what a progestin is a drug that acts like progesterone at the progesterone receptor. Deca's not a true progestin, but it is progestin-like. It does stimulate the progesterone receptor. It isn't at the same level that progesterone itself does. It's actually at a lower level. But obviously, if you've got a large amount of DECA in your system, you're going to stimulate more progesterone receptors than you would normally, even if they are stimulated at a lower level.
Sure.
So there is some impact in progesterone on prolactin, but usually, more than not, it's to do with estrogen management. Test on its own will elevate prolactin. So all steroids have the ability to elevate prolactin. What DECA does do, though, is it converts to DHN.
Okay.
As in test converts to DHT, DECA converts to THN. DECA has a higher binding affinity, but DHN is a lot weaker in its action. So DHN can supplant DHT at the receptor, as a result causing erectile issues. But you don't need huge amounts of DHT to offset that.
Okay.
I've never looked at it from a point of view. Generally speaking, I'd look at 250 mega test. And that's probably going to be good up to 600, 900 mega deca. If I went above that, I'd probably look at possibly increasing the test a bit more.
Really? Wow. That much deca you can still get away with. That you've seen people do well with that lower test. That's interesting.
I've got records of 50, 60, 100 people that have run DECA at 250 or 300 and run Tren at 600, 900. No problems whatsoever. None. But I would, if you're going to go, and a lot of this is about maintaining balances and proportions. So if you're going to go higher, I would then run a little bit more because you're going to have so much more DHN flowing around. So I would run a little bit more.
That makes sense.
I've done low test, high DECA. I've done 50-50. I've done high test, medium DECA. And I personally haven't found a huge amount of difference in me personally. But I found that with a lot of clients that when they've previously had problems with DECA, and they've been quite nervous about running low test against DECA, when they have done, they've actually found it to be quite successful. Because they manage the sides correctly. So they manage their estrogen correctly. They manage their prolactin correctly. And what we're terrible for as users is to knee-jerk react to a set of symptoms that we're presented. You know, oh, my dick doesn't work. Oh, I've got DECA dick. Right, I'm going to treble my test.
Yeah.
Oh, hang on, it might be estrogen related.
Which you could, then you'd make it worse, I bet.
Yeah. So instead of knee-jerk reaction, there's no excuse for not testing hormones now. It is so cheap.
Yeah.
You know, most of the drug testers in the UK will give you a full hormone palette, a reasonably full hormone palette, for somewhere around about 50, 60 quid. I think Medisex is about 59 quid. So you've no excuse for having a look. And within a week, you can see exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
And then manage it exactly. And that way, you're not buying expensive drugs like Cabergoline if you don't need it.
Oh, yeah, Prammy.
Yeah.
things that could cause additional side effects. Things that, like you said, expensive drugs, adding things on top that you really, I think a lot of times now people just automatically buy that stuff too. They think, well, I'm starting this cycle, so I'm going to run Kaber out the gate, you know, take a half a milligram of that, which, you know, in the thought of trying to minimize the load on your body, I would think the least amount you can use, the better, the less number of drugs, the less complicating you make it. Like you were saying about prep, you know, the simpler you can keep it, the better off you probably are in the long run.
The other thing as well is that have it on standby if you want. So you've got it there because, I mean, I don't know what it's like over there, but Kaber's a bitch to get hold of over here.
Absolutely. Even like pharmaceutical, it's expensive too.
So
whole other side topic there.
That one tub might do you good for 3 years.
Sure.
But the other thing as well is once you've done this a few times and you've got bloods,
yeah,
you start to see the patterns of how your body reacts.
Huge point right there.
So you then know going into this next cycle, I'm gonna need this around this point, or I'm not gonna need this, but I need to keep a careful eye on this because I've got 3 years of records showing what my body does with these drugs at certain doses.
Yeah,
and you start to build up a much better picture of how your body responds. So then you can become much more efficient in your cycle planning.
Absolutely.
And there are those that are just sensitive. I do have people that can't run Deca or can't run it at any level because they are just incredibly prone to problems from it. So it's not the cure-all drug for everything, but in general, it's a half-decent drug.
All right, listen, Dave. Well, let's take a really quick break here, and then when we come back, we have another question. We're going to talk a little bit about performance with PEDs, people who are doing sports versus bodybuilding, and we have an update on your movie. I'm excited to hear about that. So we'll be back in just a second, guys.
Hey, guys. Why are you using sports nutrition that was designed for someone else? At TrueNutrition.com, they offer the world's largest selection of quality protein powders, and they let you design your own custom blend from a variety of powders, flavors, boosts, and packaging options, like the Team Skip blend, for instance. That's over 20 billion possible combinations to create a protein powder tailored to your diet, your goals, your tastes, and your budget. TrueNutrition.com also offers the ability to create delicious custom oatmeal blends, and they're third-party tested, proving that all their supplements are ensured to have the highest level of quality and value. Don't be a sucker and pay for fancy packaging and gimmicks. Discover the source that bodybuilders trust and stop using mass-produced nutrition that wasn't designed for you. TrueNutrition.com. And use our code ADVICES at checkout to let them know that you support the shows.
Hey, what's up, guys? We're back. Drugs and Stuff with Dave Crossland, Scott McNally. Dave, the newspaper just reached out to you the other day. What was up with that?
They had a chat with him this morning. It was the Telegraph.
That was today.
Spoke to Telegraph today. For those who aren't in the UK, we have, I presume you've got the same over there. We have national newspapers. Obviously, we have local newspapers, but we have national newspapers. And out of those, you have your tabloids, which are your gutter press. And then you have your full sheets, which are like, you know, your more informative, non-sensationalistic newspapers.
Okay.
So the Telegraph is one of the more normal ones, shall we say, whereas the Sun would print any old fucking tosh and probably wouldn't even bother checking if it was real or not.
So like the TMZ of newspapers, basically.
I'm not sure what you have stateside. So
do you ever hear the National Enquirer?
Heard of that, yes. Yeah.
Okay, that's what it sounds like, would be like the real trashy one.
It's not to the point where it's like, oh, aliens abducted my grandmother and impregnated with you know, AIDS.
Okay.
But it is more, you just shite, really.
Okay.
Anyway, it's not somewhere I'd go for facts and information, where a Telegraph article, I would have some confidence that what was written in that was factually researched.
Okay.
So apparently there's been a report. Let me get the email up just so I get it right.
Sure.
Now, some of the wording on this was a bit shit, which I explained to her. But she's researched a story regarding the use of illegal steroids. A report today has found that drugs are being advertised on Instagram. Ooh. Well, yeah, we all know that. That's been going on for fucking donkey's years. But also there's been a rise in hospitalizations for steroid-related poisonings. Now, I said to her that, look, you don't get steroid poisonings, but obviously there are health issues that can arise from steroid use.
Yeah.
So I think that was, from what I can gather from her part, that was just a poor description. But basically this report's come out showing that obviously steroid availability is widespread. And that there is a growing number of people reporting to medical services, particularly ER, with steroid-induced serious health problems.
Huh.
So she was digging into this. So I suspect if this article is going to run, it's probably going to run in a few days' time. Generally, with the media, you find that they're not very long-term.
Okay.
You know, they'll be researching an article that's coming out in a couple of days' time. Yeah. News is particularly bad for that, as in TV news. The depending, this might be a slightly longer base research article, but something's going to hit not too for distant future, looking at the impact that the National Health Service is now seeing in the way of treating steroid users. That's probably it's going to be that area that triggers change, if anything triggers change in the UK. Because that's where it becomes a social problem, and that's where it becomes a financial problem.
Sure.
So we'll see. I mean, I said to her, I knew of people that had died from steroid use, and she's like, really, really? And I said, look, I've got no evidence whatsoever apart from the fact that I know they used and they dropped dead with a heart attack. But you don't have to be a genius to work out that if they weren't using, they would still not be, you know, they wouldn't be 6 feet under.
Yeah.
But I said, until medical services start asking the right questions, the links won't be drawn. The problem's there. People are getting health issues all the time. I mean, particularly stuff like hormone production.
Okay, sure.
So hypergonadism obviously is very commonplace in steroid users. We dismiss that as very matter of fact, but in a medical community, that's quite a severe health issue.
Absolutely.
And it's something that we're very flippant as users about and very, shit, I'll just take TRT, it's no big deal. But you speak to any doctor about that, and even if you didn't mention steroids and just said, I'm going to take a drug that's going to cause me to be drug dependent for the rest of my life, then they'll be like, whoa, that's serious shit.
Yeah.
So, you know, even on that level, there's a huge impact from the drugs. So if they do start joining the dots, so to speak, and start to link the issues that they're dealing with to usage, I suspect that we will start to see growing pressure for a change.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see too, like, are there any specific laws? Well, I know that I mean, so you're allowed to own steroids in the UK. What if it's like a UGL lab? Are you allowed to own that? Is there any difference between the law around owning that and a farm grade vial?
In fact, you're probably closer to breaking the law owning pharma grade than are using UGL, because pharma grade are prescription drugs.
But I could see people. And of course, I'm just guessing here, but it would make sense to me that there's going to be a lot more problems with the gear itself coming from UGL labs that could end somebody in a hospital. Like, we've talked about heavy metal contamination. You know, we recently talked about somebody said that their gear had rancid oil, you know, things like that. You know, you're going to run into, it seems like, more issues with that. I could see where they would want to crack down more in how the widespread availability of UGLs especially could really be making hospital visits worse.
Well, we have two bits of law that cover sort of steroids. So one bit is the 1971 Drugs Act.
Okay.
And that act states that if the drugs are for personal use, then they are legal.
Okay.
And then we have the Medicines Act, which covers prescription law. It is illegal in this country to hold a prescription drug without the valid paperwork to do so.
Huh.
It's not particularly enforced. In fact, it's very, very rarely enforced unless it's on a huge scale.
Or probably a really controlled drug like, Oxycontin or something.
Yeah, well, testosterone is a controlled drug.
Oh, okay, yeah, as it is here.
Yeah. So what the law says that if you held pharmaceutical grade that was a recognized prescription treatment in this country, technically you're breaking the law. Whereas you had a UGL, because it's generic, you're not.
Weird.
Because the prescription works around the actual drug by name and brand. It doesn't work around the type of drug. So if I had aspirin testosterone, which is prescribed in this country, without a prescription, I'm breaking the law. But if I had a form of testosterone that was pharmaceutical grade only available in Thailand,
yeah,
I'm not, because it's not a prescription drug for the UK.
Huh. That's really weird, man.
Yeah, it's a bit odd. But I said we didn't have a huge amount of time. I think she's going to come back to me later in the week. But she said, what did I want to see? And I said, well, really, education. I said, the law as it stands is perfectly adequate to police. If you want to look at steroids, whether you believe they should be or not be, makes no real difference in this argument. The fact is that they currently are, to some degree, a controlled drug. You're allowed to have them, but the supply of them, the manufacture of them, the importation is illegal. So that law in its own right is enough to enforce steroid regulation.
Okay.
Because if you control the supply, then you don't need to worry about controlling the users.
Sure.
The problem is that they try to start looking at legislation to control the users.
Mm.
Overnight, they make potentially in the region of 1 to 2 million people criminals.
Yeah.
The police don't want it. They don't have the resources, they don't have the manpower, and it's not cost-effective to prosecute.
How many over there, like if you were to go into an average gym, are there, say an average, whatever, I don't know what, you guys, I don't think you have LA Fitness, but we'll say an average gym.
We have our versions of, yes.
Okay, so an average gym where there's a lot of, you know, younger bros, is there a high percentage of people using gear? Because it's being legal, it seems like there would be a higher percentage.
The problem I think these days is that whereas you went back 20 years and you could always see a steroid user because it was reflected in the physique.
Yes. Yeah.
That just isn't the case anymore. So it's really difficult to go into a gym and say, oh, he uses, he doesn't use, because they're just not stand out.
Dude, that's mind blowing to me. I've realized this now where I find out that I'm like, oh yeah, that kid shows some potential. He's a young guy. And you know, if you were to keep training and, you know, bust his ass and stay consistent for a few years and then, you know, maybe do some geared. Oh, and then I find out this guy's already on 2 grams of shit, you know. Wait, yeah. What?
Yeah. And that's a very similar scenario to here. I'm not casting judgment on that, but sure. The facts of it are there's a huge number of people that just, in some cases, don't even look like they see the inside of a gym.
It's mind-blowing.
So it's very difficult to estimate numbers from visually looking in gyms because of this disparity we have between what someone looks like and whether they use them or.
Yeah.
But looking at sales numbers from what I can ascertain through research and looking at general numbers and research, we can confidently say we have over 1 million users.
Wow. Okay. I don't know how that compares per capita to the US, but it sounds like a lot. A lot of people that would be considered a criminal if they changed the laws.
That's about 1 to 2% of the population use steroids illicitly.
Okay.
So I think it's higher, but there's a lot of research that will back the 1 million figure. This last year's 2019 steroid survey came up with those sort of numbers. The needle exchanges three, four years ago came up with those sort of numbers, and it's definitely something that's growing. It's not something that's reducing or stagnant. But for me, it's education. You can't police this away. And the police don't want to police it away. They've quite openly said in several of the conferences and meetings that I've been at with them to discuss this subject is, we don't want a law change. Hmm. It doesn't serve us any good. In fact, it makes it harder for us. We've got enough of what we've got. We just need to learn how to use it and do it. But it's education, because I think one of the problems is that there's a lot of people that get into usage. Maybe a lot's the wrong for, but there are definitely people that get into usage who wouldn't do if they had a better grounding in how to train and how to eat and how to create results naturally.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people that could achieve their physique goals without ever turning to the chemical side of things.
Absolutely.
But at least if they're educated, they go into it with their eyes open. Excuse me. You know, they go into it with their eyes open. So as a result of that, they can make an informed decision.
Right.
And they then know what they're doing and they can make informed choices. Where at the moment, a lot of people get into steroid use not really knowing the consequences of what they're doing.
So that's kind of, I think, in part why we do shows like this. I mean, yeah. I think in general, we're probably, our demographic is probably people who are already a little bit more deeply involved. But, you know, at the same time, too, this is about general education for them.
When this subject comes up, everybody starts, oh, they should just legalize and they should just do this, they should just do that.
Yeah.
And it's like, you've got to live in the real world here. Hmm. It ain't happening. And the more evidence we get to support that these drugs can cause problems, the more the pressure is going to grow on actually doing it going the opposite way. So, because law generally, especially with around drugs and stuff, is developed to protect the idiots. It's not there because it's a good idea or a bad idea. It's there because people hurt themselves. So in order to stop them hurting themselves, we create laws that prevent them from doing it.
Yeah.
So the only people that are to blame about the increased interest in steroids and the increased interest in changing the laws are the people that have fucked themselves up because of poor education or irresponsible use.
Sure.
Potentially myself included in that, because obviously I have caused damage to myself from my drug use. So the way we stop this is to look after each other and educate each other and preach keeping each other safe and preach minimal doses used for maximum results and really push better work ethics and better diet ethics when it comes to training and diet, so we maximize our potential with a minimum amount of drugs. We can't escape that these drugs cause damage.
Yeah.
That's a medical fact. There's no denying that, you know, and it's not just because you use megally high doses at all. You can cause damage at relatively low doses over long periods of time. Mm. We can't avoid that, but what we can do if we make people as aware as we can of what they're doing and how to do it as safely as possible, then we're going to reduce the impact on National Health Services, particularly, well, in this country anyway, and social impacts, and therefore it's going to be lesser concern for law.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think education would be key. And I think, you know what, we could say the same thing about elements of, like, I don't even want to go off on this topic, but, you know, we've been watching shows about the illicit drug trade and, like, the way the narcos bring drugs into the, you know, United States and all that. And the people that are using these drugs, you know, it seems like we invest so much into stopping these things from coming in, but we can't stop it all. And at the end of the day, just like what you're talking about, education would really be a true game changer, you know, in obviously a different type of education in that case. But it does. It comes down to changing the mindset of the end user, I think, to evoke a real change versus just changing a law.
Yeah, I mean, everyone goes, oh, well, just make them legal and they're not as harmful as smoking. They're not as harmful of alcohol. They may not be, but they are still harmful. People still get fucked up. And whatever you want to believe in that, you've got to live in the real world. And the real world is that ain't fucking happening.
Yeah.
It's more likely to go the other way than it is to go towards legalization.
Yeah. Got one more topic, Dave. Okay. I'm going to jump topics here. So the last one that we were going to talk about today, performance sports and performance enhancing drugs. You know, this is something we don't talk about as much. I don't think there's as much information out there because I think most of the stuff we see when we look up, you know, steroids on the internet, it's going to relate to bodybuilding. And, you know, the cycles that we see are for bodybuilders. What is a cycle for performance look like in general from what you've seen compared to a cycle that you would see for the sport of bodybuilding and physique development?
A lot lower. Yeah. Substantially lower. Fractions.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have a great deal of experience of professional level drug cycles. Most of what I've seen is stuff that's old from what the Soviets used to do and things like that. But the Soviets were seeing quite marked improvements in definitely in field athletes with levels of tirabolin at 20 and 30, 40 milligrams a day.
And that's it.
And that's it, yeah. And I think it is very much that if you are already a highly trained athlete, which obviously these are Olympic level, then a small amount of drug intake can make a huge difference. One of the problems that us as bodybuilders face is that, generally speaking, our drug intake comes way before our performance peak does.
Hmm.
Whereas in athletics, it tends to be a little bit more the opposite way around. So they will reach an athletic peak before they start reaching for drugs.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes total sense.
Now, the Goldman dilemma, I think it is. I'll tell you in a second.
All right. I can tell you, too, one thing that kind of blew my mind. I heard an interview with Victor Conte, and he had talked about how athletes have used performance enhancing drugs for something like running, you know, sprinting versus, you know, how different that is compared to bodybuilding. That, you know, that in a case of a sprinter, they may use, we'll say they use Winstrol, for instance, that Winstrol cycle is going to take place before they actually perform. We think for bodybuilding, we were just talking earlier about, you know, people building the drugs up into a contest prep to the point where you're on stage loaded with as much as you can possibly handle, you know, versus for them, they've seen that you'll begin to develop strength, say on a Winstrol cycle, where your performance begins to actually slow down because you're also gaining some additional mass that you're holding, you know, more in the muscle, and that you will get faster, but at the same time, you become heavier, and that over time, the cycle can slow you down, where then they come off of it, and then there's a window where within a few weeks later, then they're at their absolute best, where they've tightened back up, they've lost any additional cellular retention, and they are still reaping the benefits of additional strength. It's not going to be like 100% of what they had gotten from it, but, you know, it's three steps forward and then a step and a half, two steps back. They're still faster than they would have been had they not used it.
Well, most of the research is now indicating that once you've used, you do for definitely in the short term for a long period of maybe even years.
Yeah.
Physically alter the performance permanently.
Yeah. Alex KT was talking about that.
Yes, he was. Good memory. I'm impressed. And the other thing is obviously the issue of testing around competition day or very close to competition day, which manages drug use cycles to some degree as well, because they are generally trying to avoid the detection periods.
Yeah, too. Absolutely.
Now, the Goldman dilemma is the very well-known piece of research where they looked at top athletes and asked them if they took a drug that would make them the best in the world but kill them in 5 years' time, would they use it? And about 50% said yes.
That's the Goldman dilemma. I've heard that this talked about before. I didn't know the name of it, though.
Yeah, it's called the Goldman's dilemma. More recently, that's been expanded upon.
Really?
And what was previously thought was that this would be to a greater extent within the amateur ranks. What they found is it's actually the opposite. And the amateur ramps show an indication that they're less prone to taking sport enhancement.
Really?
And what would appear to be happening definitely in professional athletics is, or professional sports, is that the drug use becomes more prevalent when they reach the top of the game. Because, and I think that a lot of that is because when they're an amateur, they still have a way to progress. They still have routes to progress.
That makes sense. There are options. They don't need to turn to that route.
When they get to the top, they get to the point where there's limited choices left.
And I think, too, for us, say when I say us, I'm saying for bodybuilding, we don't see drugs as being necessarily a negative thing. If we're doing open competitive NPC IFBB bodybuilding, we just see it as part of the game. For them, yeah. They're kind of raised to believe, you know, in the, it is against the rules in most all those situations. So,
yeah. So, you know, do professional athletes use sports? Of course they do, yes, and probably a lot more widespread than we actually realize, I would hazard a guess. But I actually did previously think that the amateur ranks were even more flooded because of the exposure that they are available to them. And it does tend to be very sport-specific. So amateur rugby has a big problem with steroid use, and I would assume that amateur American football would be a similar situation.
I would imagine.
But the performance athletics, so the running and track and field, not as much. That seems to come in much later on in their athletic careers when they're starting to peak and therefore starting to hit their genetic limits.
I know another one is amateur MMA. There's a lot of gear use in that.
I think MMA in general, there's a lot of gear use in there. But I think the sports that have developed popularity in the last 5-10 years have developed popularity with steroids in tow.
Okay.
So strongman is another one.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's really gained popularity in the last 5-10 years, and steroid use is rife within the amateur ranks. I'm not saying it shouldn't be, but the public image of strongman is drug-free. So with athletics, generally, they're clipped very much because of testing and regulation. And they are much more sensitive to adverse side effects.
What do you mean?
Well, a highly tuned world level, Olympic level, top five in the world sprinter is going to feel the negative impact of a drug very dramatically in their performance.
Because they're so tuned in.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Very small amount.
Gotcha.
So if you liken it to motorsports, a Formula One car will suffer the consequences of one tire being 2 PSI lower than another one.
Yeah.
Much, much more than a rally car would.
Gotcha.
And the bodybuilders are more the rally car. And the Olympic sprinter is more the Formula One car. So everything's so finely balanced in them as an athlete. Yeah. Small changes can have rather large impacts.
Yeah.
Whereas a bodybuilder, small changes don't tend to have the same level of impact on us.
Yeah.
So we can tolerate much more negative impacts from these drugs than someone who's on athletic performance and actually right on the point of everything they can do.
That makes sense. I hadn't thought of that before. I've seen cycles that are, like you said, much, much smaller for somebody that's involved in sport. Say, I've worked with people who have, you know, talk to me about what they've used, and we're talking things like, you know, like you had said, I think you said like 40 milligrams of T-ball. I've heard of like 20 milligrams of Anavar, you know, and that's it. But I mean, we're talking about increasing performance here. Then, you know, the thing that I mentioned, you know, another aspect is that it would be easy to do too much. You know, it'd be easy to overdo it. And even for somebody who wasn't highly tuned, to gain, you know, 8 pounds on a cycle could definitely change so much about, you know, the way that you're able to move.
Not very much so, yeah. Particularly when it's non-functioning weight as such.
Yeah. What do you think about...
So you gain muscle mass in areas that you don't use in what you do.
Yeah, there you go. CrossFit. That's one where I was just talking to somebody about this yesterday, I believe. I've seen CrossFit using cycles that are like that of an elite bodybuilder.
And yeah, I feel like CrossFit is a bit of a bastardization when it comes to drug use, because what your personal feelings are on CrossFit, let's not go down there. But
wow. I mean, I love CrossFit, Dave.
Fuck it. They
oh, you can't say that. You can't say that on this channel. You're gonna get all your sponsorship taken away.
Sorry. You very feminine individual.
did you get your eyes rolled at? Did you just get looked at by the wife?
I get judged. they borrow their drug education from bodybuilding.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's a mistake, man. I do.
Yes. And people that have been into strongman have drifted into CrossFit and taken that drug culture with them, where a lot of the other CrossFitters have come out of Olympic lifting.
Okay.
Or more athletic backgrounds. And so the drug culture from that end is a lot lighter.
Yeah.
And so, unfortunately, this influence from the bodybuilding, strongman world and powerlifting world into CrossFit has brought with it the heavy drug use.
Mm.
Which is probably for that particular sport quite counterproductive.
Yeah, yeah. I would think along the lines of wanting a increased performance, you know, and that a heavy bodybuilding style cycle could only get in the way. There's no way that I would want to have somebody on a massive amount of tren, for instance, and mess up your endurance. There's no way that I'd want somebody to be carrying an additional 15 pounds of fluid when they're trying to repeat the back pumps on D-ball from this would be, it would be terrible, man. You know?
Yeah, no, I agree. I do. I think it's probably a sport where the drug culture does not match.
Yeah.
The desire, you know, the drug culture is at odds with what they're trying to achieve. And because it's a sport that's almost a mismatch of lots of things. So it hasn't had the time to develop in the same way that bodybuilding and powerlifting and athletics has. And in time, I would suspect that over time, it will find its way with its drug policies in the sense of what is commonly prescribed within the sport as effective drug cycling. And you'll probably see that the drug doses will come down as they start to realize that these high doses and these bodybuilding style and strongman style doses are actually counterproductive for what they're trying to achieve. And the lower doses are much more beneficial to them.
Yeah. That would make sense, man.
It just needs time. It's one of those where it just needs time to develop.
Yeah. There's so many, I think too, it attracts so many people that are new to the idea of lifting. You know, I work with a few clients that are, you know, in two cases, women that are, you know, mid-30s, haven't really had a huge connection to bodybuilding in the past or physique type sports. They like to work out, and then they got involved in CrossFit. It's a way that they can go to this gym and have a community that they see these people, you know, and that they're part of something. I think that's part of it. There's like a team element to it.
The CrossFit games that I've witnessed do seem to all have team sections. It seems to be a much stronger community feel within that than it does in possibly bodybuilding and other ones.
Sure. And I think that that's gravitating a lot of these newer people who didn't have experience otherwise. And, you know, given that circumstance, it'd be easy if they go online and then they look up how to use, you know, steroids or whatever. What's going to come back is going to be bodybuilding information, you know?
But we have the same problem in bodybuilding. We have areas of bodybuilding that would be akin to a lot lower usage, but they're not. Look at bikini, women's fitness.
Very true.
Look at men's fitness classes.
Yeah.
Some of those guys are hammering cycles that put the heavyweights to shame.
Yeah, they really are too.
And it's a similar situation where they've taken drug culture from another aspect of the sport and try to shoehorn it to their section, and it's just not applicable. It doesn't need to be anywhere near that high.
That's a hell of a point. That really is.
Yeah. So, you know, it's CrossFit and the fitness classes within bodybuilding are probably very similar when it comes to their approach to drug use. Unfortunately, they've had poor teachers.
Yeah.
And it's just hopefully in time as the class has become more established and, well, very well established now, but people will start to realize that that level of drug usage is not required. Yeah. I'm not so sure if it will within the bodybuilding stuff, because I think there'll always be that over reliance on fat burners and that sort of thing to avoid that, the rigors of hard dieting. But
or to just push it that much further, you know, because let's say that I did, you know, I'm a guy who can get really, really lean. That's like that would be if I were to say I had a strength in bodybuilding, it's that I can get super conditioned. But that doesn't mean that I don't think in my head, like, well, I should still add Glenn. What about T3? You know what I mean? It's like, it's that mindset of wanting to push. And if as you've said already today, you know, like if a little bit is good, then a lot's got to be better. You know, that's the mindset.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is as well that one of the problems with the fitness classes is that their standards are nowhere near as extreme as the open classes, the bodybuilding, both in muscle mass and in condition.
Yeah.
But because they were born from bodybuilding, and initially a lot of the, this is probably a bit harsh, but a lot of the competitors were failed bodybuilders. Hmm. They came with that already bodybuilding approach to drug use.
Are you talking about like what, men's physique?
Yeah.
Okay.
But even, you know, and as a result, so that drug use was ingrained from a very early day.
Yeah.
So as a result, people entering the sport at that level just got indoctrinated into that this is what you do, this is what you use, this is how you do it.
Yeah.
And so they've never really had to experience a proper get shredded diet,
yeah,
which requires the drugs to get to that extra level of condition because it goes beyond what our bodies want to do.
Right.
And have relied on drugs to achieve a conditioning level that is perfectly achievable naturally. But because they've known no different, it's what they continue to do. You know, they've come into the sport being told that, yeah, well, when you prep for a show, you take this, this, and this, you take these fat burners. So knowing no different, that's what they've done.
Sure.
And as a result now, that's what they're always going to do.
Sure.
And then the men's fitness seems to have heavily influenced the females.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, man, I've seen nowadays some bikini girls in the pro ranks that are getting jacked. Freaking jacked, dude. Girls that are as hard and I would say as big as figure girls were, you know, a decade ago. Harder.
Yeah, now when you get to a pro level, those classes have evolved to such a point where some of those guys do carry very large amounts of muscles.
Yeah.
And then you can sort of see where the drug usage is justifiable, or at least you can see where it's coming in.
Like men's physique, absolutely. Those guys could win in a state level bodybuilding show, you know, pros in men's physique.
But at the amateur level, but the standards are improving all the time, and the classes have come on. You go back 5 years, and it was ridiculous what you were being presented wise, physique wise, in comparison to what drug use levels were being used.
Sure.
At least now in the pro ranks, you can look at a pro men's physique, and go, fucking hell, you know what I mean? That's still a quality physique with a quality level of muscle mass.
Yeah.
Different structure, focused on different areas, but you can't knock the mass they carry at that level and the quality of condition they're bringing in. But initially, it was nowhere near there.
Yeah.
And as a result, the drug usage is because of where it's come from. The drug usage have sort of come with it. I think if it's set up as a completely independent new sport and there wasn't bodybuilding existing, you would never have seen that level of drug use.
Hmm. Yeah, I could see that. I could see that for sure.
Because they wouldn't have had that feeder. And obviously a huge amount of feeder was guys dropping out of the open classes,
right,
or the weight classes, because they just couldn't make it. Right. So suddenly they had another option.
Yeah.
And they could slim down a little bit, get a bit tighter, get a bit more athletic and be very competitive in that class.
Yeah.
I mean, Classic was invented initially as a drive from the weeders to try and take bodybuilding to the Olympic Games.
Was it really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was supposed to be originally it was concepted as a drug free class.
Okay.
But it never stayed that way.
Yeah. No, I couldn't imagine it. I couldn't imagine it happening now.
But it was, that's what it was supposed to be. The classic physique was supposed to be originally not overly conditioned, classic lines, and a natural alternative. But it soon got bastardized, and part of that was to do with poor judging, in that the judging didn't understand the concept, so the judging looked and judged it like a bodybuilding show. So those with the most mass and the most condition within the weight limit were the ones that won the classes.
Yeah.
And as a result, it drove it a different way.
All right, Dave. Well, what do you say we wrap this thing up, man? Feel like we nailed this topic out. Anything else before we go? Any odds and ends or bits and bobs, as you would say?
My Hammerman film that I was in has been nominated in 6 categories in the Sports Film Festival.
Where's this at? This film.
This is held in Palermo in Italy on the 26th of January. Ooh. And you can vote for me.
How do you do that? Give me a link.
I've no idea. You need to go on the Sports Film Festival YouTube page, apparently.
Okay.
And there they show all the trailers for all the films in the festival. And you can vote. Apparently you can vote for which one you want to and then the film itself is going to be released on Vimeo and YouTube on the 1st of February.
Cool. Is that going to be like to pay for? I think it's
free.
Oh, really? Nice.
It's free. Yeah, I think it's free. It's only about 10 minutes long. It's not a big thing.
Excellent. Well, I'll look forward to seeing the release of that. And my fingers are crossed, man. I hope that this goes well.
Well, we'll see. I'm not really bothered.
All right, guys. For another episode of Drugs and Stuff with Dave Crossland, I'm Scott McNally. Go to crosslands.org.uk. And, of course, check out truenutrition.com. Guys, we will see you soon.
Take care now.